Chapter 1, Betrayed, by my family by the cruelest thing that has ever happened to me, I was collateral damage of drug and police abuse. Soon to be released in a novel titled, A Yankees Oedipus Rex Retirement Tragedy in Cary, NC. The Cary Military Police Department does not disclose the results of any internal investigation because the statutes do not permit the release of information about the department's actions. What you get instead is a thank you letter that is included at the end of this chapter. It is still legal for the Cary Military Police in Wake County to impose martial law at will under the 19th century post-civil Jim Crow laws, which they are not permitted to publicly discuss. Three biased Cary Military Police officers changed my life and my future plans, lost me millions of dollars which I can show with two documents, and brought me closer to death than at any other moment in my life as a result. The doctor told me I was lucky to be alive. The unlawful and unconstitutional actions that were committed against me when I was 62 years old by the Cary Military Police in 2009 were never disclosed to me because the statutes did not permit the release of information about the department's actions, that significantly changed the course of my life and my future plans. In 2009, I did not file a complaint against the Cary Police Department. 9 years after my first terrifying experience that changed my life, at the age of 71, in 2018, I had another run-in with the unquestionably biased, prejudiced Cary Police Department. The level of disrespect and disdain throughout this horror of a six-month period was astounding. The harm brought on by the unlawful actions the Cary Police had taken against me in 2009 were not even taken into consideration. I had both of these unjust, terrible life events happened to me while I was a senior citizen. Since I've never heard of anything similar occurring to anybody else in my life, and I'm certain either horror wouldn't have occurred to me if I hadn't moved from New York to Cary in 1988 and been a good OLE Southern guy from NC. I finally filed a complaint against the Cary Military Police for both counts in 2018. I've tried multiple times over the years to get legal counsel for my documented complaints against the Cary, North Carolina, police. I made touch with more than 50 attorneys and 12 elected officials in order to lodge a complaint against the prejudiced NC Cary police. But after realizing that neither hiring a lawyer nor getting help from elected officials was an option, I decided to go public with my complaint and created the website thenlightenedwhistleblower.com and the Twitter address at @inlee72119052. Representative Julie Von Hafen was the only elected official to respond to a six-page letter I sent to all 12 elected officials, aside from Attorney General Josh Stein, with some advice and knowledge that crimes were committed against me by the Cary police. She wrote, "Please accept my deepest sympathies for your suffering." On November 3, 2009, the worst day of my life indeed, the worst thing that has ever happened to me, I had my first encounter with the Cary Military Police and came closer to death than any other day in my life. This encounter remains the first persistently negative thought that enters my mind each day, reminding me of the consequences I have had to endure for all these years, including incurring millions of dollars in financial damages that I can fully prove. The front doorbell rang at 9:30 p.m. while I was already in bed. In the house I've owned since 1988, I was living alone. I opened the door to see what was going on, and three military personnel from the Cary Police Department barged in. They searched the first and second floors of my entire house without a warrant or any other legal documentation. They were soldiers, not police, so they did not need one, did not place me under arrest, read me my rights, or explain why they were there. I immediately pulled on a t-shirt and sweatpants after being awakened by the doorbell, and I was not wearing underwear or shoes. Later, as soon as I realized the Cary Military Police were going to remove me from my home, they instantly tightly cuffed my hands behind my back, which turned out to be for the next few hours. I do remember that one of the soldiers asked me whether I wanted to lock the front door, but for whatever reason I refused, thinking that we were heading to the Cary police station and that I would be returning shortly. I don't remember the military police ever explaining to me why they were even taking me there or where they were going. After being taken out of my house, I was driven around for around 2 hours going to different buildings before arriving at my destination, the psychiatric unit of Holly Hills Hospital. I discovered the reason the Kerry military police drove me around for about 2 hours on that evening of November 3, 2009, during my lengthy, formal police complaints process in 2018, because it was too late to find a doctor. The military police protocol required me to be examined by a doctor before being involuntarily taken to a psychiatric hospital. When I got to the hospital's psychiatric ward, the machine's limitations for blood pressure readings were surpassed. I am fortunate to be alive, the medical professional who was called to Holly Hills Psychiatric Hospital said. The doctor was obviously upset that I had been kept in handcuffs for several hours by the lone Kerry military member who was still with me. Despite having done nothing wrong, I was detained for 14 days, involuntary commitment, in the mental ward of Holly Hills Hospital. The Kerry military police never explained why they had taken such drastic measures against me. During my involuntary commitment, I shared a room with three or four other people, and I was the only one there who wasn't willingly detained for longer than 3 days. I knew the woman who was the chief of police of Kerry during this time, and recall her being in my house at least once, as one of the guests at a surprise 50th birthday party for my wife, my daughter, and I arranged. My wife and Pat were very good friends for a long time, and for years after we separated in 2005, they rented a house together for the first 2 weeks in August every summer in Topsail. My wife and Pat went to dinner together often. In fact, my wife told me a few weeks earlier they had plans to go to Savannah in late November of 2009 for a few days for a short vacation with our daughter and her two children. Although we are still married, my wife and I separated in 2005 and have been living in different residences since then. Why did this happen? On November 1, 2009, while I was playing with my daughter's then 2- and 3-year-old children in my house, my daughter went into my bedroom closet and found a prescription drug, and stole 50 of the 56 pills in the bottle. I noticed the pills were missing shortly after she left my house. Knowing she would deny stealing the pills, I wrote her a letter and gave her 2 days to return the pills. In addition to all her other issues from being divorced after only 2 years of marriage, my daughter had a serious drug and alcohol problem, and I believed she was a danger to her children and herself. When I wrote my daughter this letter, I truly believed it may have been the best action for me to take to get her some help she seriously needed. Around that time period, several of my daughter's friends told me they were concerned about her drug and alcohol issues. I still have their contact information. During that time period, my daughter had a prescription for 90 milligrams of Adderall a day plus a prescription for Xanax from some Adderall doctor she had been seeing for over 2 years in Raleigh, in addition to taking many other drugs. Plus, she was drinking vodka out of a bottle. I took the letter to my wife's house, which is 2 miles from my house where my daughter was living with her two children, but she was not there, but my wife was, so I showed the letter to her, which made her very angry, and she crumpled the letter up and threw it in my face. My wife and I were not getting along well during this time period. It was mostly about our daughter. My wife was the only person who knew our daughter and did not want to believe that she had a very serious drug and alcohol problem, even with the knowledge that drug use was the primary reason for her divorce, after only 2 years of marriage and having two children. My wife finally found out, then had to deal with years of our daughter's drug abuse, and 2 attempts of suicide. She was also in a serious car accident while high on drugs and was lucky she did not hurt her children, herself, or anyone else. She also had to be admitted to a psychiatric hospital several times in the years that followed related to serious mental breakdowns. She even finally lost custody of her two children. Both actions of both my wife and daughter and the total incompetence and complicity of the Kerry Police Department prevented my daughter from getting the help that she needed. Now it is too late. She is now a 46-year-old in poor mental and physical health who has no skills whatsoever and has been diagnosed as having a mental illness. It was totally irresponsible for the Kerry Police to have not, at least, had someone from the Kerry Police Department call me first to get a reading on my mood or frame of mind or hear my side of the story. They must have been aware that my daughter and her children were not in danger at the time of my illegal kidnapping. I did not even speak to my daughter since I gave the letter to my wife on November 1st as explained above. In addition, there were no other prior issues that would have given the Kerry police any concern, to believe, that I was a violent person, and could have been a danger to my daughter and her two young children. I have lived in the same house in Kerry. I was illegally arrested in 1988 and had no prior issues with the Kerry police at that point in time. I am not sure how many fathers can say this. I never hit or threatened either one of my children in their entire life, let alone my grandchildren who have never even seen me mad or angry. When my children were young, my wife, who had a bad temper and out of anger, would hit the children on occasions that would cause us to argue. I was held for 14 days, involuntary commitment, in the psychiatric unit of Holly Hills Hospital because of the very violent, cruel, and untrue allegations my daughter filed against me. These false allegations included not only concerns for her safety, but also, the safety of her children. My wife's mother, who I was very close to, always told me I was the best father she had ever known. I was also known by many of my children's friends as being a wonderful and generous father to both of my children, and I helped several of their friends with summer jobs while they were in college in the technology company in Kerry where I worked and held an executive position. Everyone who knew us knows I always treated my daughter with love and exceptional kindness, and to this very day, I am still devastated by what she was able to do and had planned to do to me, which I have not yet explained, and will never understand how or why she was able to do what she did. The woman who was the former chief of police in Kerry during this time period was also fully aware of the kind, loving and more than generous relationship I had with both of my children. My daughter often spoke of the great childhood she had and what a great father I had been. On the second day in the psychiatric unit of Holly Hills Hospital during the 14 days of my imprisonment, I was finally able to call my wife of almost 40 years, still not knowing why I was there, to call a lawyer or do something to help me get out. Instead, she told me to get used to this because this is how things are going to be handled from now on, and hung up the phone. There was only one phone available in this unit for patients to use, which did not work very well, so I had no other way to make phone calls. "Nobody is going to believe me, they did it once and they will do it again," is what I was thinking about during the remaining days of my imprisonment. I even had to get my daughter's permission in a group phone call to be released. During the telephone conference call, my daughter was providing me with advice on how to get along better in society when I got out. I know my wife was there, and I am not sure who else was there listening to our conversation. The paragraphs below offer my best attempt to explain the life-changing unjust consequences inflicted upon me, including an interruption of business, relating to the events that took place on November 3, 2009. To this day, I still do not have any idea how these events could have occurred in the state of NC, or in fact, any other state in the US. During the 2 weeks I spent in hell, I was wearing only a pair of Nike basketball pants and a t-shirt while most other people were wearing coats. I did not have any underpants or socks on either. I then found myself in a position where I no longer knew anyone to call to bring me warmer clothes, and had no idea how much longer I was going to be confined. If I had known why the police were there, I would never have let them in. They had no warrant to enter my house. Once again, I was never called first by anyone to get a reading on my mood or frame of mind. I was treated by the cops, nurses, and doctors as if I was this disgusting old lowlife Yankee who was a danger to my 2- and 3-year-old grandchildren. Everyone hated me. I was also thinking about what other people were being told about me. This is what I cried about when I was alone in bed at night while in the hospital for 14 days. While most of the other people who came and went while I was there were only held for only 3 days. During the 14 days I was confined, I was forced to take antidepressant meds. In the 5 minutes I was given a day, I tried my best to convince the two doctors I saw while there that I was not depressed and the charges held against me were not true. I was told by one doctor if I did not take the meds they gave me, he was going to transfer me to a state psychiatric hospital, and I could spend months, or longer, in the state hospital with no way to get out. I had taken antidepressant meds 5 years prior after I was in a car accident in 2003, which led me to retire from the company I was employed by for 20 years, and I believed antidepressant meds were dangerous and made me feel a lot worse. While I was imprisoned, my daughter was illegally in my house with other people. She dumped all my files and records all over the place and took half of them to her house. My son was able to get some of my files and records back. I never got back the 2008 tax returns that I was currently working on. During that time period, I was very busy with a startup software business I had been working on for the past few years after my retirement. I was late filing my complicated 2008 tax returns from my extension date of October 15, 2009, but was close to completing it and getting it ready to mail prior to my kidnapping. This was the first time in my life that at 62 years old I was ever late or filed an extension for filing my annual tax returns. While in my house, my daughter also stole all the other prescription and non-prescription drugs in the house, my gold rings, bracelets, everything gold and many other things of value. After I got back to my house after being released, I was not sure what was missing or knew where to begin with my records and files to complete my 2008 tax returns or where to begin with my startup software business I have worked very hard on over the past 3 years. The dog I loved was locked in one of the bedrooms, it appears, for days, and nothing was cleaned up. When I first came home and saw what happened to my house, my first impression was a crime of hate. My daughter used my credit cards during the 14 days I was imprisoned. While I was in prison, I started to think there was a conspiracy against me. I thought my wife and daughter, with the help of the police, were trying to get my money, house, and anything else I had. After my wife and I separated in 2005, I stayed in the house we lived in since 1988, and she bought a three-bedroom condo, and our daughter and her two children were living with her in 2009. My plan was, when I got out, I would get my dog and the things I needed and drive to New Jersey, where I still had relatives and friends. When I got home, I found my house trashed and one of the bedrooms where my dog must have been locked in had dog shit all over. All I could do was lay in bed for I do not recall how long. I continued to believe this for about a year, so I staggered the times that I walked my dog and drove my car as little as possible. I believed if I got stopped by the police, I would have been incarcerated, and I thought my name was on some kind of list. Most of the information provided in this document is not from my prior memories. After I was released, I waited a month before I had written a statement of character for myself, so I could write it with a clear mind. Most of the information in this document was copied and pasted from that document that I wrote during the 2009 holiday season after my release from Holly Hills Hospital. My primary intention for writing this document was to let the people who were important to me know what really happened. I knew the people I sent the statement of character to would never have believed any of the allegations my daughter filed against me for a second, and it would be impossible for me to have threatened my grandchildren or daughter. Once again, as I stated above, I had never hit or threatened either one of my two children in their lives, let alone my grandchildren. In 2009, my wife and I were separated in 2005 but remained legally married to this day. We married in 1970, and in 2009 we still had a joint investment account with Scott Trade. While I was in the hospital, my wife sold all the stock investments we had and closed the account. This was during the period of the stock market crash, and we incurred significant losses on many of our investments. The last important point I want to make on this issue is that from 1970 to 2007, my wife and I filed a joint tax return, which I always handled. This was the first time in my wife's life she had ever sold or purchased stock. This was the reason I was confined in Holly Hills Hospital for 14 days for no reason other than to give my wife some time to sell all of our investments and close our accounts. How did my drug-addicted daughter and my wife at the time, in complete denial of our daughter's drug and alcohol issues, convince a magistrate to have me committed to a psychiatric hospital at 62 years of age while having no past history of violence? In fact, just the opposite, and held for unheard 14 days without the help of my wife's good friend Pat Bazemore, the chief of the police department in Kerry. Before I provide the details of my significant financial damages relating to this civil lawsuit, it is important for me to offer a little background information about myself and what I feel was my contribution to the growth and prosperity of the town of Kerry. I have an associate's and a bachelor's degree in accounting and an MBA. I relocated to Kerry in July of 1988 with my wife and two children. The company I was working for built a new manufacturing facility in Kerry and relocated our technology manufacturing facility from Long Island, New York to Kerry. This business was one of the first new manufacturing facilities on Western Parkway in Kerry. Before living in Long Island, New York for 10 years, my family and I lived in New Jersey. Moving to Kerry was our second family company paid relocation relating to my business career. I was the company controller in 1988 when we moved our facility to NC, and I was instrumental in the construction of the new facility in Kerry. Later, I also spent 5 years as the general manager of the Kerry facility during the 17-year time period I worked in Kerry. In the last 5 years of my employment, I held the position as the chief financial officer of our international technology group, which was at the time part of a large MN-based corporation. During these last 5 years, I have mostly worked on consolidations, mergers, and acquisitions, and spent a great deal of time in Europe and Asia. The parent company also built another manufacturing facility in the adjacent lot to the facility in Kerry where I worked. A part of my duties and responsibilities required me to travel about 50% of the time. In 2003, I was in a car accident, and the injuries I incurred from my car accident left me unable to travel, so I had to retire early at 57 years old. During these 17 years while living and working as a member of the management team of this business, we added over 250 high-paying jobs in the state of NC. Most of the jobs were filled by people living in this area, and some were recruited from all over the world. During the years I held the position as general manager of the Kerry facility, we recruited two professors who had PhDs in material science from Moscow University and relocated them and their families to Kerry from Russia. This business expanded the original facility 3 times during the time of my employment in Kerry. I feel it is important to mention this because, for the 17 years that I have worked in Kerry, besides paying a great deal of state taxes, I would also like to believe my efforts helped the growth and prosperity of the town of Kerry. My W-2 income in 2004, the last full year I worked, was $334,867.82. I have done a little investing in the stock market over time. I worked on Wall Street on the stock exchange for 3 years, before I got married at 23 years old, and worked for two large institutional investment companies, both for about a year and a half. I took a course at the New York Institute of Finance to prepare to take the stockbroker's exam. I completed the course but never took the broker's test because I decided, after taking a few courses in accounting, to go to college full-time to get a degree in accounting. I have done a little investing in the stock market over time. I worked on Wall Street on the stock exchange for 3 years, before I got married at 23 years old, and worked for two large institutional investment companies, both for about a year and a half. I took a course at the New York Institute of Finance to prepare to take the stockbroker's exam. I completed the course but never took the broker's test because I decided, after taking a few courses in accounting, to go to college full-time to get a degree in accounting. In the last company I worked, we started to design computer chips for our transducers in the late 1990s for the purpose of replacing expensive circuit boards. I have been to foundries that made our chips in both the US and Europe, being very familiar with that business. After I retired in 2004, I started to follow Advanced Micro Devices, a semiconductor company based in Santa Clara, California, and did a lot of analysis between the stock prices of AMD and Intel. The acquisitions that AMD made in the 3 years that I followed this business had a share value of around $50 per share without the value of AMD, in my opinion. I still have the analytical files I created from this time period. In 2007, a few weeks after an Arabian oil-rich country took a large position in AMD for $15 per share, I made the largest investment in my life and purchased 26,500 shares of AMD stock at an average of $10.52 per share. The current stock price for AMD the last time I looked at $120 per share. While I was being held for 14 days in a psychiatric hospital for the false allegations placed against me, giving my wife time to do something she never did before, along with all our other stockholding investments, she sold our AMD stock for $5.02 per share. On November 3, 2009, we had no plans to sell the biggest investment I ever made in my life at a loss. We had no cash flow issues and no reason to sell stock or close our trading account. When I was released from the Holly Hills Hospital on November 17, 2009, the AMD stock was already back to around $12 per share. The stock price for AMD during that 2 weeks I think got as low as $1 per share. I know the big institutional investment companies and banks made a fortune during that time manipulating the price of stocks from my 3 years of experience working as a clerk on a floor of the New York Stock Exchange. In addition to my financial damages relating to my investments, in 2006, then retired, I started providing some financial support to my ex-son-in-law who purchased a dental practice. I soon became aware that could be a good business niche to build a financial model in Excel to provide dental practices some insight into the financial side of their dental practice. I had a great deal of experience developing business models from the work I did within the scope of mergers and acquisitions while I was working for my last employer, and also with the prior business I was employed for 12 years. After investing about 3 years of my time, 2009 was the first year I started getting business. I sold 53 copies of my software model for $399 each. Besides finally selling some of my business software models, I also started to provide consulting services to three dental practices in conjunction with my business model. One of my new clients owned a $10 million a year in revenue dental practice in CA performing dental implants. I was also developing a software model for him to develop day rate metrics to use to pay the 30 contract dentists who performed contract services in his dental practice. I was given the right to log in on any computer in his dental practice. After being released from the Holly Hills Hospital Psychiatric Unit on November 17, 2009, I went back to my residence and spent most of my time lying in bed for about 3 months. I was devastated, and I was aware I needed help. I was in no mental position to even open my mail, let alone complete and file my 2008 taxes or be capable of continuing working on the software business that I have been working on for the past 3 years. I believed in 2009 I could have had a successful startup business because at that time there was no software around that competed with QuickBooks, which was the basis of my startup business idea. With the exception of one argument on the phone with me, after I was released from Holly Hills Hospital, I did not speak to my wife or daughter for a long time. After about a year, my wife mailed me the handwritten letter I attached to this document. I did not press charges against the police in 2009 when was released because I was not capable of doing it. When I first filed my complaint in 2018, a woman named Tony Desimitz was the assistant chief of police at the time, and of course knew the former chief of police. Tony was promoted to the chief of police but was only in that position for a short period of time. She was sympathetic to what the Cary police did to me in both incidences, and I have an email from her to prove it, which will be included in Chapter 2. She was replaced by Chief Tony Godwin, who signed the thank you letter that was mailed to me, sweeping my two complaints under the rug based on the Cary Police Department's statutes. While conducting research for my upcoming book, A Yankees Oedipus Rex Retirement Tragedy in Cary, NC, I learned that the Cary Town Council finally made the proper decision and conducted a nationwide search to recruit a new chief of police to succeed Tony Godwin. If the town of Cary was to develop further, hiring another local guy or gal who dropped out of high school and rose to the position of chief of police before returning to school to obtain a GED and then enrolling in college to obtain an associate's degree in criminal justice would have been a grave error, which was the resume of the woman who was the chief of the Cary Police Department in 2009, who I hold responsible for the actions the Cary Police had taken against in on November 3, 2009, the worst day of my life.